Welcome to Radical Remembering with psychologist Dr. Narissa Williams. This is a weekly conversation where we explore ways we've internalized oppression and consider what it really means to live liberated. Each episode would leave you with intimate knowledge of the liberation process, sprinkle a little healing magic, and leave you with wisdom for your journey. As you get settled in for today's episode, please make sure to like and subscribe. And if you've liked what you heard at the end, please share. So welcome to another episode of Radical Remembering. We have here with us Dr. Kenneth Hardy of the Eichenberg Institute. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you. Glad to be here with you.
Good. So Dr. Hardy, most of your work right now is in racial trauma. So I think that that is really important, a topic for us to continue to explore as we think about liberation. Can you tell us a little bit more how you even came to this part in your professional career to talk as much about racial trauma as you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really has been a twin path. I mean, I think, and not necessarily in this order, first and foremost, there's the issues that continue to come up with clients that I began to see a pattern, and that, you know, the kind of suffering that was expressed, you know, didn't always neatly fall into a DSM category. And I noticed just disproportionately these people of color who bring these issues to the fore, whether it's struggling with, you know, calibrating what they consider to be referred to as anger, which, you know, I later began to conceptualize, think about and write about as rage, which I think is unique to people of color. I think it's in part to live your life and along the margins of society and not have those experiences. And so I felt really at a real disadvantage as a clinician trying to help folks navigate the experiences of their lives and didn't have the tools to do that, or even a way of conceptualizing, you know, their pain and suffering. And so the more I began to sort of track these patterns, more I began to sort of affix names to them and would see them. And I just think in our society that we're a society that places premium value on the physical over the metaphysical, and that which we name as opposed to that which is not named. So I thought it was really important to begin naming some of these issues. And then this has to do with the second piece of this, which is just it wasn't like I was a bystander watching the lives of my clients, but it was also I was also experiencing these things personally. Mm-hmm. And thinking back in times of my life where I never thought of myself as a violent person, but having all sorts of violent thoughts about just the kind of indignities and injustices that I was constantly confronted with, some really up close, front and personal, you know, like some of this would date back to even in graduate school and trying to make sense out of all that would come up. And at that point, you know, had no, forget about Black mentors, but just even folks of color, you know, no exposure, and, you know, living life at home, so to speak, you know, where I was exposed to certain things, and suddenly those issues in the workplace or in graduate school would be sort of deemed pathological, dysfunctional. And so that was a head spinning kind of experience. And so I just my own personal journey was really just thinking more about experiences. I had the fortune to grow up with a great grandmother who was a granddaughter of a slave and spent an enormous amount of time talking with me about what she referred to as man's inhumanity to man, but essentially humans and humanity to humans, and thinking about her experiences. And so I was captivated by these discussions as a young child. And so always had a curiosity about just race and what I felt to be white people's capacity to inflict pain on Black people without any, what appeared to be without any modicum of remorse or empathy or compassion. But most of these things were kind of disconnected for me, like the conversations I had with my grandmother and my parents, my experience in graduate school and then subsequently working, they were somewhat disconnected, like they were almost like isolated experiences. At some point it occurred to me, you know, that they were in fact connected. And so as I start connecting with my own life, that led me to then start looking for those connections in my clients' lives. And I think that radically shifted, you know, the way I began to think about the world, about human suffering, about the experience of marginalized people, and then my own work as a clinician. So, and so at that point, I don't think I've looked back. It's been hard for me to look at any area of psychology or mental health or any aspect in life, in fact, and not see that through a racial lens, because I think it's there for the picking, if you will, if we dare see it. But I think for the most part, we've been so incredibly socialized to not see it.
Yeah. And I jumped the gun. I didn't even start with like an introduction for you to tell us who you are and what you do. But can you share a little bit more about that? Because you can, and then I'll ask the question that I have.
Yeah. So I'm actually the founder of the Eichenberg Institute, and Eichenberg is actually my grandmother's and my mother's maiden name. So I chose it for that reason. And I often say, and you've probably heard me say this before, that I recognize it's a very complicated name with an even more complicated history. And that was all the reason why I wanted it to sort of be the namesake of my institute, because I to just honor my mother's name, but also to be reminded of the past and the path that I and we collectively have taken to get to where we are. And so I pretty much now work as a clinical and organizational consultant, doing a lot of work with organizations, helping them navigate the issues of race and social justice, and also practice as a clinician. Before doing this full-time, I served on the faculty at Syracuse University for about 17 years, actually, and training clinicians, and then held a similar position as a professor and clinical trainer at Drexel University down in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. And some of the books that you've published, can you name some for us?
Yeah, so the most recent, it's called Racial Trauma, Treating Invisible Wounds, that came out, I guess, March of 23. And then the year before that, I published an anthology called The Enduring Invisible Centrality of Whiteness. And also have a couple books on culturally sensitive supervision, one on Teens Who Hurt, which looks at adolescence and violence, and where I was looking at really putting forth a model for engaging marginalized poor and youth of color in the therapy process. And then I've done with Monica McGill, Revisioning Family Therapy, where we're looking at what we're basically calling for is a redesign of the clinical paradigm. So we're looking at issues of power and privilege and race and class and gender and all the other dimensions of diversity that provides important texture and context for our lives. And because I think for the most part, traditional mental health approaches have really stripped us of our complexity and think that we're reducible to our id, ego, and superegos. And that's all we are. And I think we're so much more than that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So when I think back to my clinical training, so in my undergrad degree, late 90s to early 2000s, and my master's degree, early 2000s, then my doctoral degree, mid 2000s to at least 10 years ago, I didn't have any, as a matter of fact, in my doctoral program, I was like, how are we studying developmental psychology and we don't talk about race at all?
Right,
we don't
talk right,
about
right.
ethnicity at all. Like right. This is madness for me. Like, and so I know my experience, I think now I can see the difference in the students that I teach now. Mm-hmm. Like, and I saw the marked difference after 2016, after Trump mm-hmm. was elected, and people really begun to, because it was such an opposing cultural stance and viewpoint, people really begun to define and think about, you know, who they are, you mm-hmm. know, different ways. And so they came to the class with preformed ideas that made the discussion so much different, right? Because before then, when I said microaggressions in class, that was the first time that they heard it. Mm-hmm. After then, they came to the class with like microaggressions and different racial trauma is a term that they have heard of now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think about that and I know what I experienced in my schooling and I'm thinking about what your training must have been like. Mm-hmm. How did you mm-hmm. like move away from, you know, because that was, I imagine there would have been a lot more resistance to you then than it would have been when I was trained, and since then, even though I know that there's still resistance in terms of like what gets published, what's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you raise that issue, because every step along, I mean, well, first of all, I just think that it's hard to lean in and have conversations about race, raise issues of race, and not have it be contentious and gendering, you know, sort of defensiveness and all of that. So every step along the way, whether it was back in graduate school in terms of what I wanted to do my dissertation on and being discouraged from looking at that. And, you know, if I express an interest in Black families and the pushback was, well, why do you want to make it about race? And so that every step along the way, there was this sort of denial about the significance of race. And then I think just professionally, I mean, I could, which I'm sure they would never, ever confess to it, but I've actually submitted articles to journals and reviewers. And I could tell from the tenor of the comments in the review that the reviewer was reactive to something I said in the article and totally oblivious to that. And I've had that experience as recently as a few months ago with the article coming out. And you know, it was, you know, these seemingly innocent questions about, well, how do you know that was racist? Or what scientific proof do you have? Or you know, that that this last piece was, you know, something I'd done on whiteness. And one of the reviewers said, notice you don't have very many references. And so that's not really a scholarly piece with so few references. And so, which to me was illustrating the very point I was writing about the dominance of white ideology, but totally oblivious to that. And so to me, that's just part of the territory. Now I've had students of color who've been dismayed by this and feel metaphorically weak in the knees when they develop their voices, which I'm always encouraging them to do, and speak up rather vociferously about race. And then there's a tsunami of pushback. And I've been saying to them, you know, like, that can't be a reason to not do it, because that when anytime you raise the issue of the specter of race, regardless of context, that you are attempting to disrupt the prevailing order, and you don't disrupt the prevailing order without there being pushback. And so this one person in particular, I know was a deeply religious person, said, you know, Jesus Christ was persecuted, so why do you think you should be excused from it? So that was meaningful to her to hear that. But and so it's gotten better. It's less of it now, but it's still there.
Yeah, definitely. When we think about how we've internalized racism, what are some ways that we do internalize racism? How does it manifest in our any context, in our at work, in our friendships, in our romantic partnerships, in our peer groups?
You know, it would be easier to answer the question in reverse, like what are the ways in which we fail to internalize it? Because I think it is pervasive. And I'm not talking about someone over there. I'm talking about just the ways in which I've been aware of it in my own being, you know, that in terms of periods of my life, how I've appraised my own physical appearance, you know, that to think unfavorably of my lips, for example, because that was the lips of Black people is always caricatures and criticized. And I grew up with a father who was born in the South, well-meaning, well-intentioned, giving me what he thought was sage fatherly advice and saying, Kenny, you know, if you want your car done right, take it to the white man. And so there's a way in which that, you know, this notion that white is better. And, you know, I grew up with that as a backdrop, and not just about in terms of getting the car fixed, but most things. I mean, it was a message that was promulgated through books at school, through television programs in my household in some way, shape, or form. And it was an unquestionable truth that, you know, it just that there was this deeply held belief that, you know, that this jingle my sister used to jump rope to, if you're white, you're all right. If you're Black, step back. If you're brown, stick around. That it's just so seamlessly integrated into the everyday lives of people of color, into our psyches. And so I think it's that, and we don't get rid of that unless there's a conscious effort to exorcise that from our psyches and our souls. And so I've been actively engaged in that process now for the, you know, for decades, just going back and weeding that out. I mean, so that that this idea that somehow that what we do has to garner white approval in order to be acceptable is just not a part of my playbook anymore. And yet, I'm sad to say, at some point in my life, it was.
Yeah, because I remember hearing people say, like, and white people were looking, and they did that in front of white people. And
yeah.
If you enjoy listening to Radical Remembering and would love to get the season dropped before everyone else, if you want exclusive invites to live and virtual events and could benefit from daily liberation inspiration, like affirmations, thought-provoking questions, and daily guidance, then download our free app, Living Liberated, in the App Store or on Google Play. You can also find the link below in the description box.
Yeah. I don't, not a part of my playbook either. Like, I don't care about the white gaze, you know? And so you said we have to exercise it, right? So what are some of the things that we do, right? So I think of liberation as a process, as a journey, you know, it's rather than a destination. It's something because we live, and in your words, I've heard you say this, because we live under white occupation, we don't have the luxury of not moving in such a way that we don't have to think about how we might be internalizing societal messages or to be passive about our social environment. And we have to be actively engaging. Right. What are some ways that you think about and talk about, like, how we exercise that?
Well, I think that this exorcism really is about challenging these dominant narratives. And so, like, it could be something as seemingly benign as the point you just raised, that us having a conscious awareness about what we say or fail to say in the presence of white people. So I'm challenging, inviting clients, supervisees, family members. It's fine to give it a thought and then say one thing more than you're comfortable saying. To put it out there, it's important. And you've heard me say this before, and I'm constantly saying that what you say is not about what support or favor it invites from the other person. It's about your ears hearing your mouth speak on behalf of the liberation of your soul. Mm. And so I think that's important. And so I think this starts with this process of exercising whiteness from the soul starts with actually very small steps, but are nonetheless very significant steps because they help to sustain it. So things like being able to name whiteness in the presence of white people, because, you know, we do have this rather bizarre thing that we do as people of color, at least I've experienced this, that when white people are present, it's almost like we're forbidden from saying white. So we say, you know, cultural groups and all these other code words we use. And I'm saying, no, let's say white. And if white people are uncomfortable hearing themselves referred to as white, then let them sit with that discomfort. Let us not own it. Which brings up the third point, is that I do believe that we have been very effective, highly skilled caretakers for white people, and that we work rather assiduously to ensure that white people don't experience any racialized pain or discomfort on our watches, even if it means we sacrifice pieces of ourselves. And that simply has to stop. And so what I'm suggesting to all of us is that, you know, that it's time for us. We've had our run as nannies and butlers and caregivers and it's time for us now to channel that energy toward ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so that at the very least, have your observing eye watch you remain quiet when you should be speaking because a white person is present, or acting in ways that are designed to promote comfort for white people, whether it's downplaying the significance of your own thoughts or feelings, or more importantly, coming after rather aggressively another person of color, which is again how we internalize this stuff, that somehow you're strong, the person next to you is fragile, so I have to come at you because you're making the person, white person next to you, uncomfortable. And no, I want us to be able to hold the capacity to allow that white person to experience the discomfort and not have to engage in self-genocide in the process, because I think that that's something historically that we've been sort of socialized to do. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I don't think we can just will our way out of it. I think it requires active resistance. And when you talk about liberation, I think that requires an action. It's not just an ideology.
Yeah, I agree. And you said, I can't remember what you just said, that reminded me of something that I thought of when you spoke earlier. When you said metaphysical, do you see this? I definitely see this. I see liberation as a spiritual path, right? It's aligning with your power and every day choosing to align with that power and power source. When you say metaphysical, are you thinking spiritual as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Can you say
because I think in our society, I mean, I think the reason why we value physicians more than we value therapists is because physicians, you can go in with a concrete, definable pain, and then there's something concrete they can offer, even if that concrete thing they offer is what they're recommending for 50 other ailments.
Right.
We find solace in that nonetheless.
Right.
Our work is a little bit more abstract. It's a little bit more metaphysical. And so it's sort of poo-pooed. You get all the science questions. Well, how do you know it's effective? And is this evidence-based and all that stuff? And so I think that the work around liberation is what I often write about and refer to as soul work. Mm-hmm. It's work that starts inside out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get a little bit dismayed when I do trainings and within the first 10 or 15 minutes, someone is asking me, well, what do I do when I get back to my job? And you're concerned about what you do, and I'm concerned about how you be.
Right.
Because I think if we focus on our being, it will actually pave a pathway to the doing. But, you know, that's less measurable. I mean, there's no statistical tool to measure that. But I do think it's important to be able to look within and do the work around the regions of one's soul, get one's soul intact. And I think that empowers us to do the kind of external work that we wish to do.
It was when you said direct that energy back to us, that was what I heard and sounded metaphysical to me too. Mm-hmm. Right? So directing all this energy outward to placating, securing, comforting whiteness,
right,
when it would be so much more strengthening for ourselves to be able to direct that energy towards us. And when I think about that too, it's like, it's not that when we take these liberatory actions or, you know, the actions that you suggest, that they'll be without consequence.
Right.
At least we have the opportunity to act in our agency, activate our voice and all those things. And so the consequences are, there are still potential consequences. But for me, I would choose that than the consequences of continuing to deny myself and to, and to hurt. Right. I've left jobs for the same reason. And people have asked wow, that's so courageous of you for you to leave that kind of job, that kind of position. And, you know, and in my head, okay, yes, it is courageous, but really it was a life or death choice to me. I could stay there and die and continue to impact my physical health, or I can leave and find my way, but be better off and extend my life because I'm not having like the same kinds of stressors and different things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think that what happens is that, and that's why I think it's important to talk about the physical and metaphysical, because what you're talking about is physically doing what's necessary to keep your job and surrendering to a kind of soul slaughter, which is what happens. And at least you leave and your soul is intact. And I think that our soul is our GPS. It is hard for us to find our way when our soul is not intact. And I think that so often our participation in white-dominated systems requires to compromise our soul. And so that it's always one more thing we're trying to achieve. If I just go along to get along, then I'll get that promotion. I'll keep my job. I'll get tenure. I'll get promotion. It's always a dangling carrot. And yet at the end of it, when, you know, we get close to achieving those markers, we have like really important questions about who are we? And what have we become in the process of getting that? And so, and I do think that that kind of spiritual yearning and the absence of concrete questions to those answers, I mean, answers to those questions, actually then contribute to this condition I really refer to as psychological homelessness. It's like I have a roof over my head, literally speaking, but there is this sense of yearning for an elusive something else that I can't quite put my finger on. I don't know what the language is. I just know that it's hard to fulfill. And the ways I go about fulfilling it, in some ways, you usually end up exacerbating the condition rather than ameliorating it. So because it's, you know, I'm looking for something external and physical that is internal and spiritual.
So it speaks to psychological homelessness. It feels, it does it speak to not feeling rooted in oneself, or is that like a not feeling rooted in environment?
It can be any and all those things. I mean, I think that you just use a key word, which is rootedness. There's an absence of rootedness. And so, like I made a brief reference earlier to Teens Who Hurt, which is a book I wrote about adolescence, and just found the research we did found that there were three levels of, in that book we refer to as community, three levels of community that adolescents had to participate in that really were life altering in some ways. And so one was primary community, which referred to family, extended community, which was not just extended family, but all the systems that youth of color participate in: school, church, temple, mosque, synagogue, police, athletic league, sports, all those things. And then a third level is a cultural community, which is about where is it that I get a sense of rootedness about who I am and what I am and what it means to be who I am. And so the adolescents that I think have the most difficulty, and I think this extends in adulthood, are those for whom each level of community has been disrupted, because I think then you're looking at a case of psychological homelessness. So rootedness is key. And, you know, I've talked about that there's some element of psychological homelessness that Black people, we have to make amends with, that we just have to live with, that we are a people of a diaspora. We have been uprooted in ways that it's hard to reconnect those roots, at least substantively and significantly. So there's some degree of homelessness that we have to grapple with, and yet it can be exacerbated by other manifestations of disconnection that we have in our lives as well. And so I think that there's homelessness and then there's chronic psychological homelessness, but what's in common is an absence of rootedness. That's where the temple of one's familiar has been destroyed. And it's hard for Black people to frequent white dominated spaces and not suffer psychological homelessness. Even when we can master code switching and developing a critical institutional self that shows up at work, but the very existence of that means that I'm constantly trapped in a revolving door where I'm moving through identities and spaces and not feeling totally grounded and rooted anywhere. Because when I'm making those accommodations at work to be white approximate or to be the gem, the good effective mainstream minority, I am forsaking pieces of who I am. And just having, just the fact of having to do that, to not have a single place where you can be your entire whole authentic self, I think perpetuates a state of psychological homelessness.
A lot of people, I know, you know, the Great Resignation since 2020, how a lot of people have left the workforce, started their own businesses. Black women lead that. I was one of them. And then there have even been research that looked at who wanted to go back to the office. Black people are more likely to want to stay home and not have to go to the office, and to talk about how, like, it's so much less cognitive load having to navigate spaces and meet up with people and at the water cooler and have conversations that don't feel authentic to you, and those kinds of things. So I can definitely see and recall, even in my own life, that experience of, you know, all right, I'm walking through the door, I got to put down, you know, put all some of me on that hook right there. All of me is not seen. It's always at an expense. I've also been places where you've worked with somebody for 5 years, and each year at the beginning of the semester, and who are you? And I'm like, I've been sitting next to you for 5 years. Oh, well, your hair is different. My hair is, but the face is not the same.
Right.
Like, So also being invisibilized often, even though your labor is, you know, very instrumental in the success of right. you know, the particular organization, and just how those things like silently kill, you know, like seek to annihilate the fullness of who you are.
Yeah, I've had those experiences where I've actually, on more than one occasion, given a keynote address and have, as I'm leaving the podium, headed to the door, just white folks stopping me and hugging me and telling me how moving the speech was, and they feel totally transformed by it. I go up to my room, change clothes, head to the airport, run into the same people in the elevator. Don't see me. Don't even recognize me. Right. And it could be like within 30 minutes, you know. Totally, you know, because I'm out of a suit and I'm out of context, and basically it's just most black people they probably don't see, you know. Right. That's happened more than one occasion, more than 10 times. I mean, I could write a book about that experience just alone. I mean,
Liberation is 100% about being in right relationship with our power. It's so easy from day to day to disconnect from our source and forget who we really are. On our app, Living Liberated, we have the tools to keep you plugged in. You'll find a library of affirmations, guided meditations, guided journeys, and tapping sequences to keep you in a state of alignment with who you really are. Topics range from self-love, healthy relationships, activating our DNA, to guided journeys with your ancestors. Download our free app, Living Liberated, and start your free 7-day trial now in the App Store or Google Play. You can also find the link for Plugged In the description box below.
It's
amazing.
Yeah. How do you feel when, so Saturday I was out, I was celebrating my anniversary, me and my husband, and then we invited two other couples with us. Mm-hmm. We ate in the restaurant, then we were going up to the bar area, sit down, continue talking. We walk in. So this question is, how do you feel when it's a person of color, you know, enacting whiteness, right? So we walk in, whole group of white people standing right here. The security is a black man. He doesn't say anything to these people, right? Mm-hmm. And we literally two steps in and he just started yelling. He was like, rah, rah, and I was completely caught off guard because I'm like, wait, what happened? Like, I can't even hear him because he's so much that he's saying right now, but he's physically even coming over to us when there were at least 20 people, you know, standing in that space, right? That was part one. Part two is I'm looking for a place to sit because there's no place to sit. I see it says nightclub, and someone had, one of the people in the restaurant said, oh, maybe you can go over to the nightclub. It's early, 10:30. My thinking is that there are seats there. It won't be full nightclub. It will feel still like a bar. Mm-hmm. And door is right there. There's nothing saying don't go in there. So I open the door to see like, oh, is this a place for us to go? Two people come rushing at me. One of them, both of them people of color, one of them, the same black man. And he's like, the way he is yelling, you would think that he caught us with something that we were stealing and different things like that. I was angry and I was yelling back at him too. Because first of all, you've assumed the lesser of me because I'm black. Right. And because my group is black, you didn't feel empowered enough to talk to the white people. So now this is displaced, you know, where you are shouting at us and all these things. For me, it's like a greater hurt when it's like, I expect it. Like my guard is already up when it's white people. Mm-hmm. And I do also have, I know that all skin folk and kin folk, right? Mm-hmm. So I do know that it's going to come, but it hurts me in a different way. I don't know how you think about that, how you feel about that.
Well, it's profoundly disappointing. I mean, it's definitely disappointing. And on good days when I'm centered, I try to understand, remind myself of the dynamics of it. That, like that person you're describing, is responding to something even much bigger than him or the two of you. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I try to keep that because I think that allows me to stay regulated in those moments when I'm thinking about, I mean, it's like I often probably don't give a talk where I don't mention Clarence Thomas because he's been a rather obsession of mine over the years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a piece of me and this that has empathy for those of us who are still trapped in the system because I'm worried and thinking that maybe at some point in my life, I could have been some version of that guard. you know, mm-hmm. because I sure as hell hope not, but I can't rule it out. Like, I can't say to you on the one hand that the indoctrination is pervasive and then say, oh, but it didn't affect me, you know? Right. And so I, at those moments, I try to go from micro to macro because it just helps me understand. It gives me a moment to then make sense about what's happening and to not personalize it as much. But there are times it's hard to get there, you know, because it is personal and it feels personal. And yet it's like I have the same experience with like these hyper Gestapo just at the airport. I can't mm-hmm. think of that, but at the security, the same type of thing. Like I've had more than one encounter with like a person of color who just like to me overreaches and has to be the super, you know, colored person there, and say, okay, well, you know, I got to try to understand that you're in a system where you probably get some kudos for doing this and this piece of your powerlessness. And so that's where I try to go. I can't say to you, I always go there, but that's where I try to go most often, is to understand that we're all like, you know, the dogs or mice have been trained in a maze to run, to do certain things. And mm-hmm. So sometimes it helps, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. Sometimes I'm able to, I was all the way dysregulated on Saturday. Sometimes I'm able to be calm enough. I mean, I also think of it sometimes as, well, this might be my only opportunity or their only opportunity to hear. And I might ask, would you have responded the same way to a white person?
Yeah.
And that didn't happen on Saturday. Saturday, I was young.
And he sounded pretty dysregulated too. So like he probably wouldn't receive that very well. And, you know,
I did say that though. I was like, what did I say to him? I was like, you don't even know who I said, you don't know who I am. You don't know who I know. And mm-hmm. which in this circumstance, because I did unconscious bias trainings for that organization mm-hmm. years mm-hmm. that restaurant for a couple of years, I did know people there, and so the general mm-hmm. manager did give us, you know, make mm-hmm. you know, greet us, make sure we had seats and whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, but it's stupid for you to, you don't even right. you're thinking right. the less of me by right. default, but no. you don't even know who I am, you know.
That is true. I mean, and the less of you and the white folks get the benefit of the doubt as being somewhat important, that he shouldn't do that too.
Exactly.
And also knows that the system will respond differently to your being aggrieved by that than would a white person being aggrieved by that.
Right. Exactly. And I told him, I was like, take the same energy to the white people. If you come to me like this, take the same energy to the white people. Right. So it was, you know, I don't know if he was listening. I was enraged. I don't even, mm-hmm. he got quiet then. I don't mm-hmm. know if it was, you don't know who I know.
No, I totally understand the rage because I mean, like I always say that I don't care what people say to me or about me, but I do care what you do. When you start, you know, denying access or opportunity, that's where I get dialed in. You can call me any name you want to call me in the alphabet. I could care less. It doesn't affect my blood pressure at all. But what does affect my blood pressure is when there's differential treatment. Now that is where I draw the line.
Yeah.
And so you're getting treatment there. So that makes it that, you know, that's hard to stay regulated when you see it so clearly. Yeah. And then it's your own your own folks, and then you're seeing that they're not seeing it.
Exactly. And I was probably personally invested too. I'm like, I've done this work here with you. Like, I don't
right.
know
right.
that because it was, you know, whatever. But I, you know.
Well, he needed a little bit more training and implicit bias. That's what I say.
Exactly. So what do you think is important, really, really important as for us to know, like, in terms of people listen to this conversation, they leave this conversation. What is the next thing to do to be able to be closer to, I guess I would use my word, liberation. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I just think the first premise I operate from is that neither you nor I can move to liberate someone else unless we've experienced some degree of self-liberation. So, mm-hmm. so I just have like this well-formulated, unshakable bias that the work starts with us and it moves inside out.
Yeah.
And so I do think that there's work that we have to do with ourselves. And there's no one of us that's been excused from this, that we all, as I often say, we all drink our water from the same well. And the well we drink our water from is a well of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And so it's not about whether it's in me, but rather the question is, how is it in me and what parts of it remain in me? And mm-hmm. because I think we have to make a conscious effort to, as I said earlier, to really weed our souls a bit, to exercise it from our bodies. And so I think that's important. I think we also then have to give ourselves a list of petite tasks that we can start with, mm-hmm. because what happens is when we go for the colossal change, because that's, you know, we all want revolutionary change, want things to happen very quickly, but that's not how most change happens.
Right.
And then when we get discouraged, then we throw our hands up and say, well, see, nothing will ever change. And so we're not in a place where we can appreciate small change. And I'm not saying we should be satisfied with small change, but I think we should appreciate it, because I think the small change invariably can lead to larger change. So if it's nothing more than my making sure, having a talk with myself in white space about the importance of my voice. Mm-hmm. And that's why I sort of crystallized a try to offer these things in little crystallized portions, so that I'm saying to myself, my goal here is to say one thing more than I'm comfortable saying, and then hold myself accountable to that. Like that's a small change that can lead to a larger change. Mm-hmm. I think, as I said earlier, being able to, our ears need to hear our mouth speak.
Yeah.
Because that's what moves our soul. Mm-hmm. And then I just, like for Black people in particular, I mean, like these are things I do every single training. I spend time on this, and it seems trivial, but I wish we would stop apologizing for, over-explaining, making excuses, and denying our anger that has been so heavily criticized and weaponized by white people, that we take a piece of affect for us that is legitimate, that's tied, that has historical roots in our bodies. And then we deny the significance of it because white people say we're too angry. And so I'm wanting us to own that narrative and say it's not anger, it's rage. And rage is what we have and what one has when something has happened to you. And racially, I've had a lot happen to me. Mm-hmm. And then to recognize that not all the rage we have is connected. We definitely have race-related rage, but it's also possible that not all the rage we have is connected to rage. It's not connected to race, mm-hmm. I think, but rage is always connected to experience of domination. So if we've experienced any aspects of our lives where we've experienced domination and marginalization, we're going to have rage. Mm-hmm. And so some of us have complex rage. We have rage that's multi-layered. Yeah. And if we deny that, then we can never have a relationship with it. Mm-hmm. And then the final thing, I'm always asking us to, I think it's important for us to de-shame our suffering. Mm-hmm. Because shame is, as you well know, is a very powerful, paralyzing emotion. Yeah. And it is shameful to acknowledge you have shame. Mm-hmm. And Black people in particular, we have been a people that have been so chronically devalued that we have lots of shame. And the shame that we have doesn't allow us to talk about the types of things we should be talking about, to seek help and assistance for and guidance for things that we should seek help for, assistance and guidance for. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is our shame gets stuffed, and in so doing, that all of the pain that's attached to it gets stuffed. And to me, that is what propels us then to look for unhealthy ways to manage ourselves, whether it's drugs and alcohol, whether it's the things that happens in families around domestic violence. I mean, it's a whole list of self-destructive behaviors that I really would love for us to have a deeper understanding about, so we could circumvent falling prey to some of those things. And so I always think it's important for us to ask ourselves, like, what is the piece of suffering in my life that's helped shape who I am? Mm-hmm. And if I can allow myself to be in relationship with my suffering in all of its ugliness, and all of its shame, it then propels me to be in a position to touch the depths of my greatness. Mm-hmm. And when I can transform that shame and that suffering into action, like, to me, that's a principal part of the liberatory process, is now I'm allowing my soul to be liberated. But that takes time, it takes commitment. And, you know, I think it's the type of thing that happens most powerfully when it can in relationships. And so I believe that because we are psychologically homeless, then to partake and find experience that allows us to have what you've heard me talk about is a homance, which are these moments of home. I think therapy can offer that. I think support groups can offer. I think afternoon in a nail salon or at a barbershop or a multitude of other places where we are congregating and where we can tell our own unique stories about ain't it awful and know that it's falling on empathic, accommodating ears. I think it's a place where healing takes place. I think it's a place where liberation takes place. And so it doesn't have to be in a formal therapy office. Mm-hmm. It just has to be where you can tell your version of the story unedited in your own words uninterruptedly and know that it's falling on empathic ears.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, important stuff. So something that a philosophy I share and something that I've watched you do both as a participant in your training and with you as a co-facilitator is mm-hmm. retemplate social engagement, right? Mm-hmm. And when I say that, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I think of Martin Luther King in one of his last speeches, and he talks about the classroom, right? Mm-hmm. It talks about the socially healing context of a classroom. And mm-hmm. years later, we see that there are still so many missed opportunities because it's school and it's work that we come together in the U.S. cross-racially for the mm-hmm. most part. Right. Mm-hmm. If there is a, you know, if it is diverse enough to even have much of a cross-racial interaction. And so I've watched you retemplate society by breaking down some of those norms in terms of whiteness, in terms of not expressing yourself, not allowing emotion. And like you said, you know, shame and how that is engaged mm-hmm. in processes. How important to that do you see? How important is that to you? And is that a way forward for our collective liberation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the ways in which, and I appreciate you mentioning this, I think the way that whiteness is so seamlessly integrated in all aspects of our lives that even when we are consciously committed to dismantling it, we can tacitly reinforce it. Mm-hmm. And I think this sort of characterization of people of color as a collective and Black people more specifically as being too emotional and too loud, all those things that we're too much of that we have equated with being professional or being even keel or acceptable. And I think it's problematic. And so I do think it's important that we reclaim our emotions, to be present with the emotions that we have, to be able to express those unapologetically, yeah. And to know that when we're doing that, it's an act of both resistance and liberation. Yeah. And when we fail to do it, it's a kind of personal incarceration that we do that, and we're reinforcing the very thing that we say that we're against. And none of this happens easily. I mean, you're going to be criticized. I mean, there's going to be pushback. And so that this work is not for the weak. And so if that sort of destabilizes you to be criticized because you're advocating people have their emotions, then you're in the wrong business. I mean, you're in the wrong work. You can't do this work. So I think that's really important. And I think it's just one of the multitude of ways that people of color and Black people have been systematically shamed. You have what is a legitimate emotion, whether it's despair and sadness or despondency or anger and rage. And somehow it's always subject to criticism and scorn in some way, some other way is better. Mm-hmm. And to get back to your earlier question, this is just another way in which it's important for us to resist and repel those internalized messages, because we believe that as well. We raise our children to believe some of this stuff, and it gets reinforced in the families. And so I think there has to be a massive disruption of it, because I think it is highly detrimental to our well-being.
Yeah. I love that. And I'm thinking the whole time we're talking about some of the most profound moments that we had when we co-facilitated together most recently. And I keep thinking about the man, the white man, who a Black woman had shared that, you know, because of whiteness, she's had to be smaller, a lesser version of herself. She doesn't want to be the loud Black woman, the angry Black woman. She doesn't even get to make, you know, she's a funny person, but she doesn't even get to make, she doesn't make jokes as much because of how, so she's self-policing so that she is not policed and in some way punished. And then a white man was able to, he said that he was thinking about just like how much he has also lost by not, you know, being able to see her in her fullness.
That's right.
And so nobody's winning. Nobody's gaining.
Nobody. Right.
The way that it is. And in this kind of retemplating, you don't have to tell them that they get to, you know, you know, you don't have to say, okay, well, I'm Dr. Hardy and I'm the lecturer and this is what you should know about these things. Right. They get to experience it. So much like you were saying, the being, they get to experience it in their body and they get to birth these new insights within themselves in a way that changes them. So I do, I agree. And I employ that in my practice too, in the sense that, you know, we have to experience each other in different ways. We have to experience ourselves racially in different ways in order for us to, because there are many of us that cognitively, oh, I'm not racist, or I want to, you know, but we haven't moved to the affective and the impact is limited.
Yeah, I think it's such an excellent point you're raising. And I do. I think that's so important because I think it makes zombies out of all of us, you know, we don't have authentic relationships. We don't have authentic conversations. We have this mythical notion about how we all should be that's based on some fabricated, unattainable goal. And so, like, I find it so exhausting and so intolerable that we still log on to those things. And so you're right in that, like that example that you described. In the absence of that they don't get to experience each other authentically, which I think is true of how we navigate relationships in our society.
Definitely. So as we close, well, I would like to know, how can people hear more from you? Like how do they learn about your events, and do you have events often?
Oh, I do. And, you know, I had someone introduce me at a conference the other day and said, it's absolutely impossible to find Ken Hardy on social media, which it is, because I don't have even the smallest of fingerprint. And that's, you know, all deliberate, but that's for another time. But anyone who's interested, we keep an active mailing list. Could email me at TEIR, which is the Eichenberg Institute for Relationships, 311@gmail.com. So TEIR.
I never picked up. That's why it was TEIR. I was like, tear.
The Eichenberg Institute for Relationships, 311 at Gmail.
We'll put that in the description box below so that people can stay abreast, learn about the events that you have, and continue to do this work.
Absolutely.
Any final words?
I just appreciate you having me. I enjoyed the conversation. I feel like I'm taking more away than I'm leaving, but I guess that's all good too.
Good.
I appreciate you doing this. I think it's a great medium to connect with our folks.
Thank you. I love it also.
Hopefully someone will play this for that security person.
I know, right? So true.
All right. Bye-bye. Take care. Keep up the great.
Thanks for listening. If you've loved what we've had to share and want to be the first to get releases of our new episodes and learn about events, download our free app, Living Liberated, in the Apple or Google Play Store.